This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
If you know of a man by the name of William McCulloch, what it's interesting is I have read of this man's life. He was a parish minister and somewhat, as it would seem, ineffective. His own son would write of this scholarly pastor who seemed to enjoy Hebrew more than he did speaking, that he was a slow speaker and very cautious. His own son would say that he was not a ready speaker and he was not eloquent. In fact, he was nicknamed the Ale Minister, A-L-E. His son writes, "The Ale Minister designated that when he rose to speak, a number of men in the audience left to quench their thirst at the local tavern. Yet God would use this Ale Minister, this slow-speaking scholar, to prepare the hearts of many people so that when Whitfield came, Scotland was ready." Frankly, I have a feeling that we would have overlooked McCulloch ourselves. We are more impressed, obviously, by the impressive people. People who are charismatic in their personality. We tend to follow those. We tend to be influenced by people who are impressive. In fact, it's a natural tendency when some well-known political or celebrity figure comes to Christ, our tendency is to say, "Wow!" It's as if, what did God ever do without that person? But now that that person is part of the kingdom, watch the church fly now. Natural tendency. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9 sums up God's attitude toward our natural thinking when he says, "My power is most fully displayed when my people are weak." Not when my people feel weak. You may not feel weak at all. But when my people are, that is, when they reckon that they are indeed stripped of anything of any import apart from my strength, it is when they are reckoning to be weak, they are weak, that my strength can be fully displayed. So we come to the study in the book of Judges, the life of Gideon here. It is obvious to me as I read and reread this chapter that the problem that God has is not so much with Gideon now, it is with Gideon's army. They are an impressive people. They have stood and volunteered to follow Gideon into battle. They number 32,000 men. That's not many, but that's a lot. And God in this chapter will work on that army, as well as Gideon, to prepare them to be recipients and displayers of his full power. Turn to Judges chapter 7 and we'll pick it up where we left it off. You'll find as we read that Gideon is probably surrounded by too many heroes and not enough servants. God will take care of that. Then in verse 1 we read, Jerubbaal, that's his nickname, remember, the Baal fighter, and all the people who were with him rose early and camped beside the spring of Herod, and the camp of Midian was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. Now it's probably from this vantage point that Gideon can see much of the Midianite army, and they number 135,000. They're described in verse 12. Look over there with me in chapter 7, verse 12. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Now that's perhaps when Gideon maybe looks at his 32,000 people. Maybe he's beginning to wonder here. And they are encamped by the spring of Herod. Interesting that the word Herod means trembling. Probably a significant feeling that Gideon is going through. He is there by the spring called Trembling. And he looks at his 32,000 cocky soldiers, though they were, and he sees this 135,000 people. And he says, "How in the world?" Now it's at this time, somewhere in this juncture, that God comes and speaks to Gideon. Look at verse 2. "And the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people who are with you are too many for me, for me to give Midian into their hands.'" I can hear Gideon saying, "Right, Lord, sure. I'm not a mathematician, I'm a farmer, but I know that 32,000 against 135,000 means that we are certainly overpowered." But God had something else in mind. Note the rest of verse 2. "The people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands, lest Israel become boastful, saying, 'Mine own power has delivered me.'" Now that says it all. The problem is not the size of the Midianite army. The problem is the size of the Israelite ego. It isn't Midianite power, it is Jewish pride that's the problem. And you get what this verse is implying? This verse is implying that even though there are only 32,000 of them, if they went into battle and were victorious, that they would take the credit. And God says, you have too many. We've got to make this thing so overbalanced that you must depend on me. So the real battle is not so much with Midian. At this point, it's with the hearts of the Israelite soldiers. They must learn what we must learn, ladies and gentlemen. And we don't necessarily like to think this way. But Jesus Christ one day said, the truth we need to relearn, without me, you can do nothing. There's not any room in that word, is there? Black and white, it's shut. Without Jesus Christ, we can accomplish nothing. So God unveils a plan that will reduce these 32,000 soldiers down substantially. Number one, he allows the secretly frightened to return home. Verse 3, this is the problem in their gut here that they're not telling the other soldiers. Now therefore come, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead. Now you remember, all of these men volunteered, so they're not shaking knees publicly. This is a sort of an inward thing. And Gideon probably, after hearing that, held his breath. Look at the next part. So 22,000 people returned, but 10,000 remained. Two-thirds said, Gideon, I am so happy you gave me a chance to rethink this. I think I'll go home. Leaving him with 10,000. Now you must remember that under the Mosaic system, the book of Deuteronomy tells us, it's interesting, that an Israelite soldier, if he is afraid, he doesn't have to fight. He can return home. Interesting draft, isn't it? The point was that the soldiers of Israel fought on a different plane than our soldiers today. These soldiers really didn't go into battle confident in themselves. Their confidence was in the Lord. So basically, a person who was afraid was a person who was not confident in the Lord. And that kind of lack of confidence is contagious. And Moses said, let's get rid of these people who spread their contagion of fear. So let's allow them to return home. And that's what happens here. So Gideon counts the men who remain, 10,000. And this is about the time his insides really begin to churn. And God speaks again in verse 4. Then the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water and I will test them for you there. The Hebrew word test could be translated smelt. It is the word of the goldsmith, the coppersmith. It isn't necessarily a test to make you stronger. It is a test to separate. What God will do is take off the dross, those who aren't afraid, but perhaps they trust their own ability. He will separate them as well down by the water. So number two is this. God will reveal at the water fountain a subtle indifference to the enemy. Let's take a look at the test in verse 5. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, you shall separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink. Now, I had to read this, and I reread it about 50 times. I'm slow, but I finally started to get the picture. There are basically two kinds of drinkers here. There are those who lap the water with their tongue, verse 5. And verse 6 adds this, as a dog laps, putting their hand to their mouth. That's the confusing thing. They are lapping from their hand. They're not lapping directly into the water. Then there are those, verse 6 adds, who kneel to drink. 9,700 of the soldiers knelt to drink. The key distinction here is that they did not use their hands. They got down on all fours. They put their face directly into the water, maybe some of them even wading into the spring. The point is that they took their eyes off the enemy. There are 300 that do this, sword in one hand, water in the other. See, what it does is it reveals a subtle difference in their attitude toward the enemy. And it is a subtle difference that must be in our own hearts as well. The victory is won, but there is respect for those we war against. It was an attitude, perhaps, not of fear, but of a lack of focus that caused these men to be separated. Those who scooped up the water remained alert, focused, and ready.
Look, verse 7.
And the Lord said to Gideon, I will deliver you with the 300 men who laughed and will give the Midianites into your hands. So let all the other people go, each man to his home. How many men now does Gideon have? Tell me. 300. 300 against 135,000. God will teach them the battle is not theirs, it is his. Helen Keller, not necessarily a theologian, but she once wrote a powerful statement. I could not find it again in my library, but let me paraphrase from what I remember. She said that the world is not moved by the mighty shoves of the powerful. The world is moved by the tiny pushes of the little. And Gideon is basically being told by God, all I need are 300 little pushes, and we're going to move the Midianite world. Verse 8. So the 300 men took the people's provisions and their trumpets into their hands, and Gideon sent all the other men of Israel, each to his tent, but retained the 300 men, and the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. Now, if there's ever a night he had trouble sleeping, it was this one. And in the middle of the night, God comes to Gideon again and speaks. And I'm sure Gideon's first reaction is, no, Lord, 300 isn't too many here. But God has something else in mind. And I imagine that Gideon on this evening is trying his best. He isn't necessarily the most courageous man. Trusting God, yes, but afraid somewhat. He's probably trying to keep his chin up. He's not being naive. He's just trying to be faithful. Like that general who was rather naive but had a great positive attitude. He had a small band of soldiers, and on the day of battle, he got up before his men and he said, men, you know that we're surrounded, so don't let any of them get away. That may be a great attitude, but I'm not sure it'll win. Perhaps Gideon is thinking, 300? Well, at least we can surround them, but God comes basically to speak, and I love verse 9. Out of this entire chapter, these next two verses speak most to me. Now the same night it came about that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hands. The next verse is absolutely incredible. But if you are afraid to go down, go with Purah, your servant, down to the camp, and you will hear what they say. And afterward your hands will be strengthened so that you may go down against the camp. The compassion and the patience of God is fantastic. He doesn't say, Gideon, what in the world are you waiting for? Attack! He says, it is time to attack, but I want to develop you. So why don't you slip down there with your servant and go take a look at what I'm already doing in the camp of the Midianite soldiers. God, in effect, says, I want to teach you how to take that next step. I've led you this far. I will lead you through the next one. If I was walking through our living room, our stairwell to my left, walking into the dining room, and just as I got to the foot of the stairs, my son on the top stair says, Dad, catch! And I said, ah! You know, which being interpreted means, don't jump! If you do, we're going to go out the wall and land in the backyard. You know, as I thought about that, it was fascinating, because I can remember, like yesterday, propping that little tyke up on the second stair and saying, jump! Come on, jump! And you know, he's writhing, and this is a game all parents play. We like to terrorize our kids. And I'm saying, come on, I'll catch you, I'll catch you, I'll catch you. Come on, all you have to do is jump. Jump. I won't feed you if you don't jump. And finally, you know, their hands actually touching yours, they, in this sheer ecstasy of fear, they kind of teeter off, and we catch them. And we're thrilled that they would trust us like they do. Then what do? Now, go up to the eighth step and jump. No. It's about 15 times on the second one. And then on the third one. And here my son, you know, on the 10th, says, Dad, catch! He has gone beyond my ability to catch him. But his faith in me is something to behold. What step are you on? You know, the wonderful thing about it is, if you're on the first step, God doesn't say, oh my goodness. You should. The first step, he says, jump. And then as our faith is developed, we start sliding it up. And I find Gideon here somewhere around the third or the fourth step. He's beyond his ability to touch, but he's a little afraid. By the way, he doesn't know at this point what the battle plan is. That's very critical to understand. God hasn't revealed it yet. So God says, Gideon, I want to encourage you to take the leap. So I want you to take your servant, go down to Midianite camp, and I have prepared encouragement for you from the most unusual lip, the lips of a Midianite soldier, verse 13. When Gideon came, behold, he's sneaking up to the camp now. A man was relating a dream to his friend, and he said, behold, I had a dream. A loaf of barley bread was tumbling into the camp of Midian, and it came to the tent, and it struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. Just as Gideon sneaks up, 135,000 men, maybe 75,000, 80,000 tents, he comes to the right one. And just as he arrives, one of the Midianite soldiers wakes up out of his sleep, and he wakes up his buddy, and he says, you won't believe this dream I just had. It's interesting that God gave that pagan soldier revelation for Gideon. The little barley would represent Israel. We can see how it makes sense. Barley was the bread of the poor people. It was usually fed to cattle. But since Israel has been in famine conditions, they are eating barley. And the tent would be a symbol of the nomadic Midianite peoples. But for some strange reason, that strange dream was given an interpretation by the other Midianite soldier. Evidently, God gave it to him, and he said, oh, that makes sense. He said, Israel is coming against us, and they're going to strike us down. What God allowed Gideon here was the privilege of peeking behind the scenes at the providences of God. Let's just run right through them quickly. God provided the dream for the Midianite guard. God arranged for Gideon to arrive just at the right time. In fact, he directed his steps to the right point. Third, God allowed the other soldier to interpret correctly the dream. God assured Gideon's safety. That is, he wasn't even detected. He wasn't caught. He was able to sneak into the camp with sentries posted and sneak out. And finally, God created the fear in the Midianite hearts. That is, he was already at work lowering the morale. He just allowed Gideon to see the providences of God. What a wonderful illustration for you and me. Sometimes we really wonder, is God at work? But he is, behind the scenes. Perhaps we can't see it all. But even in the lives of worldlings, he has them exactly where he wants them. God is at work, in fact, in your life. Ladies and gentlemen, when you and I understand that God is indeed at work, it will lead us to do one thing, worship. And there outside that Midianite tent, in the dark cover of night, Gideon and his soldier friend, his servant, knelt and they worshiped God. Gideon returns and arouses his troops. Verse 15, look at that. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands. And he divided the 300 men into three companies. Evidently, God told him how to do it. The text doesn't let us in on that. And he put trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them, with torches inside the pitchers to cover the light, until they broke them. Verse 17, and he said to them, look at me and do likewise. And behold, when I come to the outskirts of the tent of the camp, do as I do. When I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you also blow the trumpets all around the camp and say, shout for the Lord and for Gideon. Here are your weapons. You've got a trumpet to blow, ram's horn. You've got a torch to wave, made in that custom of that day, in a smoldering substance that would burst into flame whenever they waved it. You have a pitcher to break, and you have a voice to shout. No sword, no shields, no rushing attack. That's it. Let's read for ourselves what happened. I'll just make brief comments as we go through the text. Verse 19. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. This is between 10 and 11 p.m. When they had just posted the watch, that is, just before the sentries could get accustomed to the darkness of the night. And they blew the trumpets, that would sound like 1,000 battle charges, and they smashed the pitchers that were in their hands. Now, the smashing did a couple of things. Number one, it exposed their torches so that they could see the light now, and it also created tremendous noise. That undoubtedly would stampede the thousands of camels inside the camp. And they probably did more damage in destroying Midianite soldiers than even the Midianite swords themselves. So they smashed them. Verse 20. When the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing and cried, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon," which is interesting because they didn't have any swords. Verse 21. And each stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran. Now, God had already put fear into all of their hearts. We don't know that perhaps he had that dream multiplied throughout the camp and the interpretation of it. They were already terrified. You get the picture here. These torches are now exposed, and 300 soldiers that are surrounding the camp on the hillside begin to wave them, and they are shouting, "In the name of Yahweh and Gideon!" They smashed the pitchers. Now camels are stampeding. Men are rushing out of their tents, grogged with sleep. They grab their swords and they begin to do, thinking the Israelites are already creating havoc in the camp. They begin to swing. Camels stampede. And all the soldiers are doing is standing on the hillside, waving their torches. Every once in a while saying, "I think I'll blow my trumpet. I think I'll shout now." J. Vernon McGee wrote that the torches served only as light for the Midianites to see just enough to go after each other. 120,000 Midianites fell. And the Israelites never entered the camp. They never waved their sword. They never engaged the men in combat. They just stood on the side of the hill and hollered. Let me apply this very obviously, three ways. When we are at our smallest, God can be at His greatest. When we are at our weakest, God is at His strongest. And you can never be too small for God to use, but you can be too big. The only hero, the only one worth worshiping, is the one who waged and who won the battle. There isn't any room in Judges chapter 7 for heroes, just human beings who leapt from the top stair into the everlasting arms of God.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.